Welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. Here you will find Dr. Cindy Elliser and Kat McKeever, researchers at Pacific Mammal Research, talking all about marine mammals. We will have a variety of ways to share information with you through discussing research articles and news stories, interviews with other researchers, and more. Join us to learn more about marine mammals and have some fun.
Welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And today we are super excited because as soon as this paper came, we've been waiting. The marine mammal community, I think, has been, who have known about this, have been kind of waiting for this paper to come out. It's been in the works for the last couple of years. We've been collecting data and whatnot. And we've heard about these incidents happening. And so we couldn't wait for this paper to come out. So it came out. We're like, well, that's an easy choice for the journal review. That's
what we're doing. I know. For once, it was like, oh, there was no decision making. It was like, oh, no, this is what we're doing. Perfect.
That's it, obviously. So this is harassment and killing of porpoises, also known as phocinicide or porpoiside. We may use either one of those terms, by fish eating southern resident killer whales or Cynus orca. And this is by Giles et al. In Marine Mammal Science. And it was just in September.
September is when it came out.
August 30th, but it was released in September. Mm-hmm. And this is a veritable who's who of marine mammal researchers in this list of authors. There's a lot of big names on it, which is pretty cool because there's just so many people. There's a lot of different orca researchers out there, and they've all kind of seen these different times and different things over the large range of time that this paper was done. So it's very cool to see all those names kind of together in this very unique paper. Mm-hmm. So without further ado, we'll get right into it because it is very interesting. So just to start off, right, resident killer whales only eat salmon. And yes. These guys, the southern residents, really like Chinook.
So just to clarify, resident killer whales only eat fish. Not specifically salmon. Our southern residents prefer salmon, but resident killer whales in places like Norway, for example, will almost exclusively eat things like herring. So just to go fully zoom out, first of all, there's there's various different ecotypes of orcas. Let's just start off by saying that if you're not familiar at all, orcas are an extremely diverse species in the sense of what they eat and how specialized they can become in specific food sources. So there are these kind of blocks of like resident, which are fish eating killer whales, mammal eating killer whales, and then animals that sort of cross the boundary and eat all of the above. And then there's also ones that specialize in like sharks and things like that. So just as like the full zoomed out picture of orcas, they do seem to have this ability to become very, very specialized with specific food sources. So like Cindy said, our southern resident killer whales here in the Salish Sea prefer salmonids as their fish of choice.
And mainly Chinook. It's a very large percentage that's what they eat. The northern residents, for example, eat a wider variety of salmon. And it's very interesting that here it is a very distinct. These guys eat fish. The bigs or transient killer whales eat marine mammals, and they don't do the other thing. They may kill other things, but not eat them. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that, obviously, for the paper. But we'll also talk about big killer whales doing things that they don't killing things that they don't eat. So it's a very interesting thing where people would see they have seen this in the past, and didn't know what to make of it. And this is the paper's over a long period of time, looking at this historically all the way up through mainly current times. So what we're looking at is the ability to be able to differentiate between a predatory behavior and non-predatory or non-consumptive behavior, right? So the main point here is that they kill the porpoises, but they do not eat them. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes hard to know that because a lot of times they take the prey below and then you don't know if they eat it or not, right? Or there's diet studies, you find out from there if they're in their poo. but being able to differentiate those is difficult, and particularly in the marine world. And a part of that is because there's observation limitations, and then what we interpret the behavior as can be a little bit biased based on our own experiences and what we think we see, we're seeing in the animals, since we're still learning about them.
Right.
So this phocinocide or porpoicide, and phocinocide is a really fun word to say. I may end up saying porpoicide more because it's just an easier one to say, but yeah, either way, they mean the same thing. So the this is not unique to the southern residents here. Porpoicide is mainly observed in smaller dolphins, and particularly, I mean, when I hear porpoicide, I think moray firth, bottlenose dolphins.
Yeah, yeah. I remember watching a it was a special on British television when I was in high school about the moray firth dolphins in Scotland ramming and killing porpoises, and it was this very sort of CSI style of documentary. I was fascinated by it. I was like, oh my gosh, they do what? Wild.
Look, why are they doing it? Like, and they'll, you know, they'll pop them out of the air. It's not a pretty sight. But that I think that was the first time that really came out in the literature and in the public view of like these animals do this kind of thing on a larger scale, right? And then there's also apparently several species of lags or Lagenorhynchus, but I'll just shorten that to lags because it's easier. So I thought it was interesting. I didn't really heard as much about those ones doing it, but it's not surprising that it's in other places. So why is the question, right? And with the ones with the bottlenose dolphins in moray firth, and that's as early as 1996. So these have been happening for a long time, and we still really don't fully know why they do it. We have, you know, there's hypothesis and evidence that points to one way or the other, but we're still not, you know, completely sure. It can include suggested causes. Include prey competition. So they're taking out, if they're eating the same thing, you take out your competition, then you get more food. And also that also goes with feeding interference. Kleptoparasitism, so stealing another baby, which has been observed. Practice related to fighting, predation, or infanticide. So some animals will kill the babies to make the females go back into estrus so that they can possibly be the father. And that's generally done by males for obvious reasons. And then in response to perceived threat or young or an ill conspecific. There's also sexual aggression or high testosterone in males, right? They have to beat up something when that happens. Male or conspecific bonding, so they're doing something together. Displaced epimeletic behavior or mismothering. So this is, epimeletic is when you're taking care of where's the definition?
An offspring.
They define it at the end, and I just want to make sure I get it right. It's a seemingly altruistic action toward another that is ill, dying, or dead. So they're trying to help somebody that's not doing them. Mismothering could be like, oh, you're trying to be the mother to this baby that's not yours, like another species, you know, kind of thing. The list goes on. Territoriality of site or resources. So you're getting in my space, get out. Or aberrant behavior by an individual. So.
Right. There are just those weirdos, you know, weirdos that do random things, which again, it's so fascinating that there have been so many postulations and so many suggestions as to what might be causing this and what might be the ultimate reason behind this type of harassment or killing of porpoises. But it's so interesting to me that even at this point we really don't know.
And because we can't ask them, right? I mean, we can assume from evidence of what it is and be close to what we think it is, but you know, in the end we can't ask the whales like, hey, why do you do this?
Yeah.
That'd be super awesome.
Yep.
We'd make our lives so much easier. But so then it's also been proposed as a form of object-oriented play. So it might just be fun. Which orcas, and I'll mention this again later, but orcas have been equated as the cats of the sea because they can do that sometimes. They will do surplus killing where they'll just kill something but not eat it for, and we'll talk about why. but that kind of playful, you ever seen a bird like go after a cat go after a bird, and then it like sits there and play, like toys with it, right? It's like, oh, I'm gonna kill you, Nona. Oh, let it go. I'm gonna let you go. So it may just be that, which, and play does have a very important part of any social animal in learning about what they need to do in life. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily that it's a bad thing. It just doesn't seem good on the outside of it for the animal that's being played with. And so this object-oriented play, though, is when the act does not contribute to the immediate survival of the individual, but can have cognitive, physical, or social and developmental benefits. So doing that is not going to help them because they're not eating it, but it's chasing it like they would prey. So the muscle memory is getting better, the cognition of being able to follow the prey and do what they need to do, the social bonding, the brain development, all that kind of stuff. That's what play does, right? That's why kids play, right? And mm-hmm. any social animal, the young play to figure out how to fight, how to be friends, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's a great practice zone.
Mm-hmm. A safe practice zone, right? Like mm-hmm. there's, nothing, there's lower stakes. Like nothing's going to happen if you don't catch the porpoise, except for the porpoise survives, which would be good for it. They put it in reference of the fact that harassment and killing of non-prey species are not unique to marine mammals, right? This is pretty common. They have it in, for example, lions kill cheetahs and wild dogs, suppressing the wild dog populations, but not the cheetah, which is interesting. So
mm-hmm. I know, I thought that was curious. I want to research that more.
Like, well, why is it impacting the dogs so much? Okay. Maybe that's the reproductive thing. I don't know. It's interesting. And then so they did a review of interspecific killing among terrestrial mammals, and there was 97 pairwise interactions involving 27 different killer and 54 victim species.
Right. So pretty widespread, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes they eat the whatever non-prey item that they killed, and sometimes they don't. Like, I even saw this in the Bahamas when I was out there. There's these dogs that are on the island, just kind of wild dogs. And they were chasing a bird. I'm like, oh, that's funny. They're chasing a bird. They caught the bird. Oh, they killed the bird. Oh, okay. And then he like kind of nuzzled with it and maybe kind of chewed it like a chew toy and then just left it. So even our sweet, more domesticated dogs will do it. And cats, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's not new, but it is, this behavior has not been previously documented in the literature. As we'll see, there's a lot of evidence of it for decades, but they just haven't put it out into the literature, because sometimes it's, I just saw that once or here or whatever. You don't realize that it's that widespread until kind of later in time. So I don't think we really need to go over too much more about the Southern residents. I think most people know the Southern residents, but it is a very well-studied population. It is endangered. There are, I think, 75 right now as of the last census in July with the two babies from Alpine. Mm-hmm. But they are broken up into J-pod, K-pod, and L-pod, which are socially and genetically distinct units. And then we have along the coast here of North America and from California to Alaska, they will go from southeastern Alaska to California and within the Salish Sea, which is the inland waters of Washington State in Canada. So they eat exclusively fish, primarily Chinook. That constitutes 50 to 100% of the diet depending on the season. So depending on when the runs are going, they'll eat different fish, but during the Chinook run, they basically just really only want to eat those. Generally because the Chinook are the largest and I think the fattiest. So it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, most bang for your buck.
Exactly. Just in my head, you read my mind. So they're, they are very high risk of extinction because of the scarcity of salmon, vessel disturbance and noise, and legacy contaminants. So contaminants that we've gotten, we don't use anymore, but are still in the environment, and probably some new ones too, honestly. And then on top of that, they've got inbreeding to deal with. So that's great. I think it's only two males that have fathered calves that we know of in the last 20 years, I think it is.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something close to that. There was a recent paper on it that came out just like this year or last year. So that's another hard thing. And then on top of that, climate change. So, you know, they've got a lot going against them.
Yeah.
They've been anecdotally reported to harass and kill but not consume harbor porpoises and Dall's porpoises. And again, the reports had not been well studied until now. So that's what they did. They collected and analyzed historical incidents of these in the Salish Sea. And so this is kind of similar to what we did with the harbor porpoise asphyxiation, you know, choking on large fish, right? When we did that study, we were like, wait, I wonder if this has happened before. And then we looked historically and found there was a lot that just hadn't been put in literature, right? For whatever reasons. So this is very similar. It's always important to kind of, you know, think like, let's see if there's more of this if we've just noticed this here, right? How long has it been going on in the past that we just haven't put into the scientific literature?
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a few different hypotheses, but they're looking at, you know, if juveniles are doing it more, it's probably for developmental play or practice hunting. We'll talk about the prey size. What the size of Chinook is very similar to a calf of either porpoise species, so that's could be a reason. It could be if it's largely performed by mature males, then the behavior might be sociosexual, right? So like, hey, look, I killed a porpoise, ladies. What do you think? or a form of sexual aggression. If it's mainly observed by reproductive age females, that could be more of the displaced epimeletic behavior, where they're trying to, you know, nurse another cat, you know, nurse something else. It's a baby that they lost their baby, that kind of thing. And so then they also, which is really important because this is a social species and culture is a large part of their, it is becoming more clear that there are many species that have some sort of culture. And the southern resident killer whales are believed to, at least
I was going to say, I don't really know where you're going with that.
Yeah, there's a specific word I'm thinking of and I can't think of it, but that's okay. Many people, researchers in general, believe that, you know, that there is culture. They have these different dialects, vocalizations. They have fads that they have done. We'll talk about those later. And so looking at the transmission of this behavior within the matrilines, right? The residents live in tight matrilines. That's another important thing for us to know. They basically live with their mothers their entire life. So the male and the female stay with the mother their entire life, which is very unique. That is not common in the mammal world.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
So these matrilines are very strong, strongly connected. And then how does that transmit? Did it get transmitted within the population? And through the matrilines, which would be another indication of a culture. And remember that females stay active in their groups after menopause, right? So they go through menopause, they don't have babies anymore, but they are still very involved in the social lives of these animals and the knowledge holders for the younger generation.
Yeah.
It's thought to that those matrilineal group structure and that postmenopausal of the moms is thought to promote knowledge sharing between matriarchs and offspring and facilitate cultural transmission of information and behavior. So this could be part of that. So they wanted to look at that transmission, right? Is it going down the lines and then across the lines and across the pods? They kind of end the introduction as, if porpoise harassment is spread between pods, this behavior could mark the first recorded case of harassment of a non-prey species being introduced as part of the southern resident killer whale culture. So kind of a big thing.
Yeah, pretty huge deal.
Yeah. So the methods, they are pretty in-depth, and we're going to gloss over a lot of it.
Yeah, and I will say this just so you don't feel like you're missing out. This is an open access paper. So if you guys are interested in diving into the details of this more or just reading it for yourselves, I highly recommend it. We will put the link in the show notes to access the paper, and it is open access. So anyone can get access to this and read it.
Yeah. Then we're going to give you the gist of it without, like, they're doing like mixed models and all these other things. And there's a lot of stats and stuff involved in that. And we're just going to tell you what they did and what the results were. So they first have you, of course, you have to define what harassment means, right? That's always the first step, right? What do you mean when you're looking at, because there's a wide range of behaviors that are happening that could constitute harassment versus not harassment. And you have to make sure everybody agrees on what that looks like. Mm-hmm. So it's an incident of porpoise harassment as one in which southern resident killer whales interacted with the porpoise in a manner that could have immediately harmed the porpoise, which sometimes includes the killing of the porpoise. So with this, I think they looked at it, and then all the incidents they were looking at, all the authors agreed that that fit that definition. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is another cool one in that they used researcher information and data, and then they also included whale watch organizations that have observed that behavior, as well as members of the public. So another great mm-hmm. example that it's not just researchers that are collecting this data and that can help inform the scientific literature.
Yeah. And especially for something like this, that is this kind of very broad scale looking back in time. Like, I love that they really maximize the resources that they had available to them. And again, like, you know, we'll talk a little bit in a moment about who they actually source this information from, but I just thought it was a really, really cool list, like you said, and it's nice to see people being open to more than just research organizations as being these sources of really important information.
Yeah, because just using the researchers would have quite a bit less data, especially with the mm-hmm. whale watching. Like, there's a lot that are out there. That this is what we can get from those whale watch groups, is this kind of important information that we wouldn't otherwise be able to get, because we just can't be out there all the time. And the we being the collective marine mammal researcher we, not us. Mm-hmm. We're not researching like this.
Yeah.
So they classified things as either a confirmed kill, a suspected kill, or an unknown outcome. And both confirmed kills and suspected kills were considered phocenocide because they were ultimately presumed to result in the killing of the porpoise. So even if they didn't see the porpoise die, like, at the last point of seeing it, they're like, yeah, that porpoise isn't going to survive. And these are experts in marine mammal world. They have a good guess as to whether a porpoise is going to be able to survive a particular event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was confirmed if one or more of the southern residents were observed the live porpoise, and by the end of the observation, it was dead, obvious. And then also if observers found a freshly deceased porpoise immediately after the southern resident killer whales were observed to have been present in an area, and no marine mammal eating killer whales had recently been documented in the area. So it's likely that that was the case. Sometimes they were able to collect the porpoise and do a necropsy, which is great. And in all the cases that they did that, the primary cause of death was killer whale induced trauma. So
yeah, so pretty decisive.
Yeah, like, and that's what happened. Okay. And I think there's only one case, we'll get to it, but there is only one case where they had underlying pneumonia. So it maybe that was why it was easier for them to kill it, but it didn't die from the pneumonia. The unknown outcome. So then if the health or survival of the porpoise was not evident, cases were defined as suspected kill or unknown outcome. And these are basically when there's not a complete observation, they couldn't see from like the beginning to the end, either they came in the middle or they didn't see the end of it or something like that. And so it's suspected kills, including incidents where events suggested the porpoise ultimately died, even if it wasn't seen last alive by the observers. And so examples like physical mutilation, likely to have caused mortality, or the porpoise never surfaced again. Like, well, it can only hold its breath for a few minutes, so it's mm-hmm. probably not going to survive. And there are also causes of suspected kills when observers arrived on the scene when the southern residents were interacting with the dead porpoise. It's likely that they didn't just find a dead porpoise floating around and start playing with it.
Right, exactly.
And then in such cases, the southern residents could have found a previously dead deceased porpoise, but unlikely that would happen. The unknown outcome was when harassment was observed, but an inference could not be made about the health or survival of the outcome of the porpoise. So sometimes it might look like, oh, the porpoise was still okay when they left it. Well, it could have gotten away, but we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they looked at basically between the pods, sex, age, class, individual, and matriline to look at this transmission and then who was the who of doing it. Age classes were calf was 0 to 2, juvenile is 3 to 10. Sprouter males, I love the term sprouter, super cute, is 11 to 19. And that's because their dorsal fins basically sprout up really quickly to that large shape. Mature or adult males, physically mature or adult males at greater than 20 years. Reproductive females 11 to 42 and post-reproductive 43 or older. And matrilines were defined as a set of individuals with a known common maternal ancestor. So they know that they're related to those other animals.
Mm-hmm.
So here we're going to get into, this is where we're glossing over a bit more, the analysis of it. They use the data collected by the Center for Whale Research, who is the basically the one who does the census for every year for these animals. So they've been looking at the animals since 1976, so really couldn't go before that. And they looked at annual rates of porpoise harassment for each pod, each sex, each age class, and individual. And the annual rate was defined as the number of porpoise harassment or killing incidents by each southern resident killer whale grouping, whether you're talking about pod, sex, age class, or individual, divided by the number of days that grouping or individual was observed by the Center for Whale Research over that year. So that's the basic metric that they use for all these analyses. How many times did you see the group, whatever group you're talking about, do the thing versus how often they were in the same sea?
Right.
So there are limitations to that. The number of days that the residents were observed by Center for Whale Research does not equal the number of days the individuals were actually in the Salish Sea, because they can't be everywhere. And they only do, you can only go out so many times. You're not out every single day. And Salish Sea is kind of large. So you're not going to be able to do a transect of the whole thing every day. And so they do recognize that this provides a limitation to the analysis. However, it is the most complete and reliable data set that they have to be able to use. Mm-hmm. So it's the best path forward. And then sampling efforts, incidents during the summer months from 2005 to 2020 was likely higher in previous years because there were more whale watch operations in business during that period, more research vessels in the area, and more non-commercial whale watching was occurring as well. And federal listing of the southern residents happened in 2005 in the U.S. So basically they're like, okay, well, we really need to keep an eye on these guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a little bias in effort that they're just putting out there. So basically the rest of the methods is about how exactly they are looking at these different groupings, and they are using things like mixed models with poison error structure. They're using binomial generalized linear mixed models to determine the probability that an individual whale would engage in a porpoise or killing or harassment. So we're just kind of lump all of the stuff that we're going to talk about was done by these kind of more complex statistical models that were used to analyze the data. And I think that's all we're going to say about it.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I'll say is just the benefit of using this type of mixed modeling is that it allows you to pull out which interactions are actually significant with other ones. So it allows you to, so it allows you to start correlating specific things with other things within that data input. So just to have a little intro there or teaser before we get into the results of what they found, that's kind of the benefit of these type of mixed models.
Yeah, so because you can put like sex and age and pod. And so, okay, so which one is the actual one that's making, or which two? Like, what are the interactions between those groups that are saying, hey, this is what's happening?
Yeah.
They also did split the, to increase the what they can get out of the data, the significance, they split the period into two time periods. So they could also see, like, is it increasing from period one to period two, that kind of thing. And they split the, they used 2005 as the split point. I think that there's a lot of reasons for that, where based on the effort and then the endangered species status at 2005. And it just made sense to kind of make that. And it was a more equal distribution of period one versus period two.
Mm-hmm.
And then What's interesting too is that they wanted to see, you know, they're looking at the individual, like how often is this individual doing it? Well, can you figure out, is there certain individuals in the population that are doing it more than somebody else? So looking at these, being able to dive a little bit deeper into the analysis of some of these statistics that they're doing allowed them to determine if one or a select few individuals were driving the results, right? Is it, are you guys the problem?
Right, right. Which is super important to know. And especially, you know, we've talked about this in other podcasts where when you do have those one or two individuals doing something a little crazy, those could be really skewing the results if you don't know that it's a specific individual. So really, really good point.
Yeah, yeah. Could be like, oh, there's 20 of them. Oh, there's all the animals doing it. Like, no, that was just one guy. Skewing everything. And then they looked at the difference between sex and age class. They did for this because they're doing kind of individuals, that one they had to use the data across all the years versus doing annual rates, because they just didn't have enough data doing it annual, because they may only do it like 5 times in the year. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they had to pool the data to be able to get some significant information out of it. Side note, they also did, they gathered observations by killer whale scientists in the, for the northern resident killer whales and the Alaska resident killer whales, just to have some comparisons, like, is it just the southern residents that are doing this weird behavior, or others that are along the coast here that they might, you know, see at some point in their travels, are they doing it as well? There was no analyzation of those results because there were so few. Just a spoiler. That's just more of a description. So that's where we're at. So we're going to be looking at how often these porpoiside events happened in these various different pods, individuals, age classes, and sex over the amount of time that they were in the area, and using lots of cool statistical models that you can read about if you want. And with that, we'll let that sink in, and we'll take a quick break and be right back. Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the Research Director at Pacific Mammal Research, and I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes, as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast, and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy. All right, we're back. So let's get into the results. So there were 78 total incidents of this between 1962 and 2020. So they did take
a huge time span.
It's huge, right? It's like, yeah, that's, you know, almost 60 years.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty crazy. So you'll note that we said 1976. But there are some in the literature that they used so there was a couple incidents in the literature that they were able to use have those a little bit earlier years. So about 36% of those incidents were classified as posthenicide, and 64% were, 36% were classified as posthenicide, and 64% were undetermined outcome. The consumption of the porpoise, again, is very important, was never observed in any of these, nor was thought to have happened in any of these incidents. Mm-hmm. Most of them were harbor porpoises, sad face. 72% were harbor porpoises, while 17% were dolls, and 11.5% were unknown porpoise species. And we'll talk about why, but most of them were single porpoises, so they weren't going after big groups, although there was a couple instances of that. Like 91% were single porpoises. Mm-hmm. And then when they were able to, when they knew the age class of the porpoise, 80% of them involved neonates or calves, and 20% were subadults or adults. So very, very highly skewed towards babies, which makes it kind of worse.
I know. It's sad.
Really, guys? Okay. There were two incidents that were between 5 and 15 porpoises were involved. And there was another one that had a couple mother calf pairs that were there. But again, the majority were going after single individuals. The observations were equally distributed between researchers and whale watch organizations, 43 and 39, so pretty much equal, with 14 observed by both parties. 6 were documented in literature, and 6 were reported by the public on the sighting network. Then they have the necropsies that they did on 7 porpoises, included 6 harbor porpoises and 1 dolls. And again, well, we spoiled this, but the death was from killer whale-induced trauma. But what's interesting about that is that they range from severe, right? So extensive cutaneous skin punctures and or abrasions, internal hemorrhage, including hemothorax and hemoperitoneum, to very subtle lesions that were only discernible microscopically, which I thought was very interesting.
Really, yeah, like a vast range of trauma to the bodies.
Yeah, and some ones that, like, if you saw the porpoise floating, you might not have known. Like, sometimes it's obvious, like, well, that got obliterated by a killer whale. And other ones is like, well, it's just there. And you wouldn't know unless you microscopically looked at the tissue.
Mm-hmm. And even then, if you didn't have any correlation between it having been in association with a killer whale, again, right. Like, for some of these, it was microscopic evidence of hemorrhaging. Well, that could, you mean, you could just assign that to any sort of blunt force trauma that you didn't know what it was from. So, yeah very important to note that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So most incidents, most of them occurred around the San Juan Islands, but that's also, where most of the effort occurred, right? That's where the biggest whale watching and where the researchers are based. So there's some skew just from effort.
Also, up until fairly recently, that's where the southern residents really hung out the majority of the summery time, which is when most people are out on boats. So up until really the last 5 to 10 years, that's really where these animals were. So just again, there's a little bit of, like Cindy said, a little bit of an effort bias there, both because the animals are present there more frequently and just because our efforts are concentrated there too.
Yeah. I mean, I think basically when we moved here not 10 years ago, that's when it started to shift. Right. They were still here a little bit, but then they really started not being here as much. So the harassment lasted anywhere from 3 to 300 minutes. That's 5 hours.
Right. Isn't that wild?
And I really hope that the porpoise was killed earlier in that and wasn't like alive for close to 5 hours before dying.
I know. Makes me wonder if any of heart attack.
Right.
I mean, honestly, like you just wonder.
Yeah. Well, my dog accidentally killed a bunny. Like she was chasing it and she grabbed it and I was like, drop it. And then she dropped it. And then it was like, freaking out. We put it back in and but then it died of a heart attack. Right. So you can die of fright, basically.
Yeah.
So who knows? So basically the behaviors, they began with chasing the porpoise. And then once it was caught, they would push it, hold it in their mouth and carry or balance it above the water. Mostly atop the rostrum or melon, but also on the abdomen and sometimes between them. They're like, hey, let's carry this porpoise. Whee!
Mm-hmm.
Funny. Whale watchers reported that some were toying with it, what we talked about before, like with the cats, allowing it to escape before recapturing it, and then resuming the behaviors of pushing and carrying and balancing. Mm-hmm. Others were high activity and ramming and tossing the porpoise. And we've seen some pictures, oh my God, of them being just tossed like 50 feet in the air.
Yeah, it is very similar to the pictures that you might have seen of the mammal eating killer whales tossing things like seals or otters into the air. It looks very, very similar to that behavior.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's actually what I'm thinking of the pictures of, but they could have been a southern resident, I wouldn't have known. And so then they might ram and toss the porpoise with the flukes, thrashing the porpoise in the mouth or raking the porpoise. Two incidents involved residents repeatedly releasing the dead porpoise and then diving to retrieve it. So, and I will warn you that in the paper, there are somewhat graphic pictures of these types of things happening. So mm-hmm. if you don't want to see it, maybe don't look at the paper or flip through. So these are mostly, God, my voice does not want to cooperate today. they were mostly, the big overarching here, mostly a single pod in any given incident and mostly a single match line. Mm-hmm. So 77% had two or more killer whales. So 2 to 4 is kind of the average size. And only 22% had different match lines. So basically it's one match line that is doing the behavior at a time. And then this is one of the most interesting things is that L-pod were the instigators.
Yep.
Very clearly. So, and that was actually started in, that was the 1962, why they started in 1962, because when they were actually trying to capture them for the aquaria trade, which that's a whole other topic, they witnessed one of these events. And that actually the killer whales were pursued with the intention of capturing the aquarium. But during the operation, the female died that they were trying to capture. But that's when they saw an adult male and adult female chasing a porpoise in Harrow Strait. Yep. So they did bring the carcass back to shore, and they found 150 pounds of salmon in the stomach. So it was a southern method.
Right. Also, what I think is interesting about that, though, is, again, it goes to what we've already alluded to, which is that this animal wasn't hungry. You know, this does not seem to be a prey-related or a hunger oriented behavior. You know, they are that female had a lot of salmon in her stomach.
She was not hungry. She was well fed.
Right. So just again, I just wanted to point that out because it is just another indicator that this is most likely nothing to do with hungry animals, you know, who are starving to death going after a new species. This seems to be unrelated to hunger levels.
Yeah.
In the killer whales.
Exactly. Very good point. And so then basically it was L pod who started it. L pod was seen engaging it more than K, but not more than J, but J was more than K.
Like this is where it gets a little, like it's again, these comparisons and like the mixed models, it gets a little confusing. Basically L pod was mostly doing it.
Yeah.
J pod did it more than K pod. And so basically it was L pod most, J kind of middling amount, and then K was the least amount observed
but
doing this
did
behavior.
It before J.
Right. Really can very, you know, confusing. Interesting. So
the big thing is L pod did it more than J or K generally, and and started it all. That's really what you want to come away with for this part. Most were observed in the summer for the obvious reasons we've already talked about, and it peaked in 2005, again, because for the things we already talked about.
Yeah.
But they did so that, you know, the L pod is the first pod, and then to K, and then to J. So it was transmitted across within the population, right? This was not just everybody randomly did it on their own and it happened, voila. Somebody started it and then everybody learned it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also increased. So period one was really interesting. This was really interesting. In period one, L did it more than J or K, by far. But during period two, 2005 and later, they were all equal. There was no significant
difference. Right. So that at that point, all pods are doing it to an equal extent.
Right. So that really does show that transmission.
Yeah.
And then also to increase the support for that, the K pod increased their rate across period one and two, and there's weak support that J pod also increased the rate, but I think they had fewer to go on just because they started later in the process. But L pod rate did not change. So L pod started it and they're doing it at this equal rate, and then everybody else learned it and they kind of bumped up to that constant rate.
Right.
So again, transmission.
Yeah, really interesting.
Yeah. When they're looking at, this gets a bit more confusing, but basically there were four whales that did it the most. And guess what? They were in L pod.
So, well, two of them were in L pod, two of them were J pod.
Oh, were they? I don't know. The beginning part here was the L pod guys.
There were four whales that interacted with porpoises most often. There was L5, L73, J31, and J36.
Yeah. Oh, I see. I just started reading L and just saw L.
Yeah, this is where, again, having these letter and numerical naming things can get a little, you got to read carefully.
Yeah, you know, you're very, very good. I totally missed that. Yeah, so there you go. But there were four whales, basically, that were the most prolific at it. Mm-hmm. Only identified L-pod members did it before 2000. Mm-hmm. And there was a member of an L-pod had more probability of doing that behavior than either J or K.
Right.
Kind of makes sense. For between the sexes, there were no sex differences. So it's unlikely that it's a male-dominated thing for the sociosexual part. 33% started as juveniles, and then so there was some indication of that they are learning it young and then continuing to do it as they get older. 59% of females, the first time they did it was started at a reproductive age, so that links to some of that epimeletic behavior possibly. But juvenile females were the most over any other age or sex class, but it wasn't significant, but that was only in relation to being it, they did it more than post-reproductive females. There wasn't a significant difference between juvenile females and calves and reproductive females. That one was a little bit confusing.
Yeah.
But they were significant because that one interaction was significant. For males, it was juvenile males that did it the most. but there was no significant difference between the male age classes. So there's this indication of numerically, the base data shows that they did it the most, but there wasn't significance in the comparisons.
Right. And this is where, again, we get into sort of the difference between looking at raw numbers versus running statistical analyses. So this is where it can sound a little confusing or contradictory, but that's basically what, you know, what we're talking about here is, like Cindy said, the raw data, raw numbers versus are there actually statistically significant differences between these things?
Yeah. And then they have like a histogram plot, like a box plot type thing. Then you can see that the juvenile females and reproductive females and juvenile males all had higher amounts, but they're pretty close to the other. Mm-hmm. So that's where the significance mm-hmm. comes in, or lack thereof.
Yeah.
19 matrilines had the, did it, but most had few numbers of times they did it, right? So they kind of tried it out and they're like, maybe this isn't for me. And then seven with the most incidents with more than 10 each. So there's certain matrilines seem to be more prone to do it than others. and it has been, you know, the corpus arresting behavior appears to have been transmitted through and retained within matrilines and over and so they do it within the matriline, and then they're, you know, young ones, the juveniles are doing it, and then conceivably they're being taught and then maybe teaching their kids, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So social learning. And then what's interesting is there some continue to do it, they learn as they're young, and others never do it. There's animals that were there while the other animals are doing it, but never interacted themselves. Mm-hmm. So really interesting that there's this individual differences of like, okay, well, you can go wear a salmon on your head or you can go wear red shoes, but I'm not going to do it, but I'll be around.
Right.
You. Yeah. And so finally, I love the Northern and Alaska resident killer whales is like five sentences. It's just like,
I know.
Well, they did it a few times. That's all we got. So Northern residents did it five times and Alaska residents have done it two times that they've documented. And two of those seven were suspected deaths. So
right. They
also do.
Again, not exclusive to Southern residents, but again, we don't have the data to really know if it's something they're doing consistently or not up there.
But to that end, they are pretty well studied, right? So the Northern residents are studied quite intensively as well. So the fact that they don't see that much means they probably don't do it as much as the Southern residents. So, you know, basically this has been happening over the last 45 years and it seems to be increasing in frequency and spreading across the population. Crazy. And that's what really is neat about this long-term kind of data set, right? Is to be able to see mm-hmm. that really big picture, right? And so basically we're going to go through the different options of the hypotheses. The first one is play, right? It does look like it's consistent with the definition of play, where it does not contribute to the immediate survival. It is spontaneous yet intentional and pleasurable. It represents a modification of an inherent behavior. It is repeated but not rigid, and it does not occur during other behavioral states such as foraging, breeding, or defense. Right? They're doing it specifically to do that thing. It's not a byproduct. Mm-hmm. It's also associated more with younger individuals, which we did see quite a few juveniles doing this. And juvenile Southern residents of both sexes had the highest engagement in this behavior. But there was not significantly different from the other level of engagement of the other ones, as we just talked about. But again, we're not seeing these like 100 times a year. Right. It's like 5 or 6 times a year or something like that. So it may be that just statistically, we don't have the numbers to be able to see that difference. And maybe mm-hmm. there's no difference, but still juveniles seem to do it more. they also see multiple age class cooperation, where the animals will sometimes like put the porpoise in between the two of them, and like it appears like it is a game where the goal was to keep the porpoise out of the water. Like how, right. It's like hacky sack,
right? With a porpoise.
With the porpoise, poor thing. Hmm. So that's considered what's called object-oriented play, and could have indirect benefits for things like group coordination, cohesion, and social affiliation. And that's been hypothesized for the bottlenose dolphins that do it in other places. It's like, you know, it's like playing a game. Like you go and play soccer together, you're going to be a team. You're going to have those connections. And so it's very, very possible that that's what is the indirect benefits that they're getting from this. Mm-hmm. It could also help with skills for hunting because, you know, manipulating or positioning it in the mouth could be, you know, strengthen the whale's physical condition, improve skills for successful hunting. But sometimes they'll continue engaging the porpoise well after it had died. So it's indicating the killing of the porpoise was not the purpose.
Right.
They're still playing with that instead.
Right. And again, like these two things are often interactive, right? So it's again, like it's hard to determine what's, again, like thinking about big cats, right? What is play and what is practice for real hunting? They're likely often very interrelated and very much both feeding into one another in terms of learning behaviors and learning, like you said, all those locomotive and cognitive skills that are required. So right. Teasing that out and trying to determine, is this exclusively play or is this hunting practice or is this play that's resulting in hunting practice? We don't know, basically.
Yeah, I think it's likely both. I mean, that's what play is.
I think
is,
so, yeah. Right? Yeah.
And we see that with spotted dolphins in the Bahamas. They'll go after these big barjacks. They don't eat them. But they're figuring out how to use their echolocation, how to chase after fish. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's probably fun, right? Mm-hmm. And so they do say that in some ways advantageous or may just be pleasurable to the whales. It may just be an enjoyable thing. Like there's lots of stuff that we do that don't make sense. Like let's go play cards. Let's go play whatever. Like, mm-hmm. Do anything really, but it helps your memory. It helps those other things. But you're doing it because right. you like it, not because it's doing those things for you. Mm-hmm. So they did note that the post-reproductive females who have the most experience hunting did it the least. So it may not be, you know, they don't need to, basically. So it could be a form of hunting training. So the younger ones are doing it because they have to figure out how. And again, you know, harbor porpoises are 80 centimeters in length and 7.7 kilograms at birth. Dolls are 100 centimeters and 11.3 kilograms at birth. Chinook salmon, adult Chinook salmon, are probably 90 centimeters and weigh 13.5 kilograms. So they are very similar to the size of Chinook that they would be going after. So very likely it could be a good way to practice hunting. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, differentiating, as Kat said, between hunting and play is not always possible. The biggest killer whales in the Salish Sea engage in surplus killing, where they will kill a harbor seal but not eat it. And it's likely that it's showing the calves and juveniles how to hunt. Right? Like, oh, we're not hungry right now, but this is how you do it. Mm-hmm. Right? Low stakes, again. And then there's other ones in, like, off of South Africa, Argentina, and Antarctica that also eat brain birds, which would have no nutritional value for them, really, I don't think. It's like popcorn.
That's been documented in Shetland, too, actually.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I think the picture that I have
from the eider, the eider ducks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty gnarly.
So it's likely that that's just more practice than anything else. They're not getting mm-hmm. a lot of bang for your buck out of those birds. And then in a direct comparison, their biggest killer whales have been observed harassing but not consuming salmon. So mm-hmm. exact correlation, right? They're just doing it to do it, not to actually eat it. So it could be practical salmon hunting. So that behavior, the porpoise harassing behavior, could provide both practical salmon hunting practice and play that benefits group cohesion, coordination, and bonding. So it is a combo, mm-hmm. combo effect. The displaced epimeletic behavior epimeletism.
It's hard to say.
It is. is often characterized by one or more adults keeping a conspecific afloat or attempting to resuscitate it. So again, the animals carrying the porpoise in between the two, the lifting or carrying the porpoise on the back, head, rostrum, or the mouth, cradling the porpoise between multiple individuals, could be seen as an attempt to keep and seeming to try to keep the porpoise above the water, or swimming with the porpoise in echelon or baby position. Those are similar to epimeletic behaviors that are observed. So,
right. So it's possible there's a little bit of that going on, maybe.
Right. And the first ones, the females first engaged in porpoise harassing behavior were of reproductive age. So a lot of the majority of females that started it at that time were reproductively active. So that they would be the most likely to engage in that. So it could be some of what's happening. It's not sex related. So there was no difference between the males and females. Everybody did. They don't think it's infanticide, right? So there are populations and animals that will kill babies to, again, put the female into estrus so that they can be the fathers. But due to the style of interactions compared to the more aggressive attacks in cetacean infanticide across taxa, it's not likely that this is what that was for, right? Mm-hmm. Even though this behavior has been documented in the Biggs population. So
right.
They have done that, but doesn't seem to be here. So the other part of it, they looked at, you know, is there dietary overlap? So would they be kicking the porpoises off to get to their prey because they are trying to steal it, right? Mm-hmm. And they, you know, there's very minimal diet overlap between the southern residents and the porpoises, generally because porpoises, from our perspective, harbor porpoises don't, at least they used to not eat salmon, right? We personally here at Pac-Man have documented that they do catch salmon and consume it and prefer, most likely do eat it, but that's more recent and not as common. It's not, you know, we've seen it a few times. It's not a big part of their diet, even if they mm-hmm. are taking some salmon. So it's not, and they're certainly not taking adult Chinook.
Right. I mean, as we've just said, they're basically the same size as a full-grown Chinook. So yeah, so not so advisable.
I mean, that would be a very crazy porpoise to try that. Mm-hmm. So that basically largely rules out the hypothesis of it being due to prey competition or feeding interference. But it was interesting that that feeding interference or kleptoparasitism could incite a southern resident killer whale attack. Apparently, Dahl's porpoises and Pacific white-sided, part of the LAGS group, has been observed stealing remnants of salmon from the northern residents during food sharing. So they rip, you know, these animals rip it apart and there's little pieces. So it's almost like they're gulls.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to grab the food. So that was interesting. I had never actually heard about that before. But, you know, they do say, like, well, the presents are probably annoying, but to the whales, there's been no overt aggression toward them. Like, don't really care right. if they take a small bite of their food. Like, not a big deal. Also, it's probably a waste of energy. It takes considerable energy to chase the porpoise and do all these behaviors that they're doing with them. And that would be silly to do. It's just a waste of energy to do that because they took a small piece of your food.
Mm-hmm. Especially if it's just one individual porpoise to which most of these interactions were, it's highly unlikely they would actually bother.
Yeah.
Even if this was happening.
That's fine. You take a piece. Not a big deal. So then the other part of it was that they appear to target harbor porpoises more than dolls. Dolls are faster. And if you've ever seen them at the surface, you see water more than you do the animal. And so some of it is likely due that dolls are just harder to catch. But it also mirrors the trend that we see in the populations where harbor porpoises used to be around a lot and then they weren't, and then we saw more dolls. But now since the 2000s, that's flipped again. And now we see harbor porpoises and we rarely see dolls. So, and that's when that's been increasing, you know, since that 2000-2005 cutoff, and everything's been increasing and more of those have been since the 2000s. Prior to 1994, 6 out of the 10 harassments were dolls. And after the early 2000s, the harbor porpoises became the main target. So it's likely due to that fluctuation in the porpoise populations itself.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense. So they also did look at the overlap between the calving seasonality. So calves are born in late summer, usually August, September, maybe sometime in July for the porpoises. And again, neonates and calves were the ones that were more often the target. And that coincides with the time that the southern residents, at least previous to about 10 years ago, were in the summer. Like, that's generally when they're here the most. So,
right.
Correlation.
Yeah, hard to tease that one apart, really.
Right, but it like makes sense. Like, yeah, they're both around the same time. So that kind of makes sense as to why that we see that more often. And then it's also easier to catch a young than adult. Not that they can't, they obviously have and do, but it certainly is easier to catch a baby, unfortunately, for the baby. But also, I wonder, throughout this whole thing, I was like, where's the mom? Mm-hmm. Right? So they didn't really talk about if they saw the mother calf together and it separated and they took the calf, or like, you know, what happened to get the calf or that young away from the mother. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting.
Right. I mean, if they're juveniles, that makes more sense. You know, right. They might presumably are not with the mother anymore, but right. Exactly. For some of these that were neonates, for example.
Yeah.
What was going on there? Yeah.
What happened to the mom? Mm-hmm. So that's another interesting part of the puzzle that we just don't know about yet. So the porpoises that were killed were healthy. They seemingly had no other reason to die besides the fact that they were attacked by a southern resident killer whale. And again, those subtle microscopic scars would mean that sometimes these could be missed. Also, it could be hard to know whether if you found a deceased porpoise, was it killed by a southern resident or a transient or a big killer whale? Most of the time, the ones that are done by the big killer whales have like broken bones and amputations and
a little more violent.
A little more violent. But that's not saying if they rammed it really hard and then didn't eat it or something, it would have the same microscopic lesions that they see with the southern resident one. So
yeah.
it's hard to know sometimes. So they did, you know, we've shown that they transmitted this across the match lines. What's really interesting is so they retained it within the match line. They learned it over the years. It spread throughout the population. Now there are only 4 match lines that have never been seen doing it,
mm-hmm.
which
is like, pretty crazy.
Yeah. It starts with like 1 match line and now literally everybody's doing it. So it's really neat to be, again, to be able to have that long-term data set to show that, like that this is spreading to the population. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it originated with L-pod. More than K and J, but again, everybody's doing it. Only 4 match lines or not. And so we're looking at how's that happening? That's part of that culture discussion of the social learning, right? It's possible that this behavior is spread via social learning. And this fits that the fact that it's transmitted within match lines and diffused between pods, the behavior fits the definitions, some definitions of culture, which have been broadly defined as information that can affect individuals' behavior that is acquired from others through social learning. Mm-hmm. And so this is where we get to the fad part, right? So K-pod, back in 1987, one female from K-pod carried a dead salmon on her head. Who knows why? Fashion. That's never been seen before. And then within weeks, members of J and L pods had learned it and repeated the same behavior, but then it was not observed again the next summer. So it was like a hot thing to do. And then
right. For some bizarre reason.
Very similar to our human fashion trends. Sometimes you look back and you're like, wow, why do we do that?
Yep. Yep.
And then in other killer whales off of the coast of South Africa have been recorded consuming the liver of great white sharks, which may have been spread between individuals, like learning how to do that. And there's many other examples and other cetacean species, including humpback whale songs, signature whistles in bottlenose dolphins, the sponging behavior of bottlenose dolphins in Shark Bay. Only certain individuals do that, and they learn it from their mothers. The vocal clans and sperm whales. And I thought it was interesting that they didn't mention the vocal dialects in the resident killer whales.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting because that is also an indication of culture, right? You have your own way of speaking. So it's very likely that this could be part of a new behavior within the culture of these animals. Mm-hmm. And so, as we mentioned, the northern residents and the Alaskan residents do it as well, but not very much. So we don't basically just don't know why. why is it more common? And that was culture, right? Why do certain things in our culture happen like in the South versus the North versus over in India versus over in Europe? You know, there's various different cultures for different reasons that, you know, we don't really know why not everybody does it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting, you know, point to be made about culture and how those variations happen and why they happen and if we ever will know why it happens, besides mm-hmm. just certain individuals like to do things.
I think the one thing that really does highlight, though, is again, you know, this variation between killer whale ecotypes,
mm-hmm.
how much it does extend just beyond dietary preference. This is actually cultural and genetic differences between these different ecotypes. So again, just you know, in kind of a nice summary of that, it's like, well, these are very different populations of animals, and they really, you know, it's not something that we can ascribe to all resident killer whale types.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and mm-hmm. and that there are those differences that are important in how populations are different and how they are conserved. You know,
mm-hmm.
not everybody's the same, and so the same conservation efforts will not work in different places. And, you know, so they say the southern resident killer whales are salmon specialists, and their dietary preferences likely be reinforced culturally and genetically over thousands of years of specialization. And so that goes back to like, well, why aren't they eating the porpoises? If they're starving, why don't they just eat them? Like, well, because it's a cultural and genetic and, you know, social, like it's a whole thing that you don't just switch.
Right.
And they do say that with that in mind, southern resident killer whale, piscina side, does not suggest that southern resident killer whales will eventually include porpoises in their diet. So mm-hmm. there's your answer. Unlikely to happen. Ultimately, like other, I love this sentence. Ultimately, like other predators, killer whales are capable of chasing animals they do not kill, intentionally or not, and killing animals they do not eat, including prey and non-prey items. So it's a wide range of why they do these certain things. It's not it's not just like I only kill and I only eat this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty common. So the last part they have is going over limitations, right? We already talked about the limitations in the CWR data, the Center for Whale Research. When they're looking at the age and sex, could have been influenced by low sample size, because again, it was, you know, by the individual and by without looking at the broad scale, there's fewer points in their data analysis to be able to draw conclusions from, so that low sample size might influence why we didn't see some significance within those groupings. Effort is different, right? Especially the last 20 years, effort from researchers, whale watchers, and the public has just increased. It just has. We've become more interested in them. So it's likely that we see that more during that time frame because of that. The summer months is also a bias, because if you've ever been out in the Pacific Northwest, it's beautiful time.
Mm-hmm.
That's when everybody's out in the water as well. It is harder to be out on the water in the winter and the springtime months and the fall, but particularly the winter. So we just don't get out as much. And then what's really interesting, I thought that was a really good point to make, is that there was not enough data to include in the analysis the southern resident killer whales that were present but did not engage in porpoise harassing behavior. So it limits our understanding of the sociality of this behavior. Again, why do certain individuals do it and others don't, and they just watch?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why? If we could only ask them, let's go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
and then the last one was that they define match lines based on a common female ancestor and do not distinguish between changing social groups over time. So there have been some guys that have like switched over a pod for a little while and then maybe gone back or gone off on their own. So there is more than just the genetic basis to those social groupings, but it's harder to tease apart and to know about, and smaller sample size for those odd individuals that do that. Mm-hmm. But that could be another part of how this is all working. So
right.
It's important to point that out. So that's it. That's a longer discussion about porpoiside and why they do it, and that we still really don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, just, I really like their, I'm just going to read the last two sentences of the paper, oh, yeah. because I think it's a really nice, you know, we have talked mm-hmm. about an awful lot of different hypotheses here. So just to kind of condense that all for you guys is like the takeaways. So
this
last two lines, last two sentences from the paper itself. So quote, in conclusion, possible explanations as to why the southern resident killer whales harass and kill porpoises include the behavior being a form of play, practice fighting, and or displaced epimeletic behavior. Porpoise harassing behavior appears to have been transmitted within matrilines and between pods, and is likely an example of culture in the southern resident killer whale population. So just a really nice summing up of everything we just talked about in this paper, because there's a lot of information that we covered.
And it's really hard to do that in two sentences, and that's pretty much it. Like, that was really good summary of everything. And I think really important to emphasize again that culture, right? That the research world is becoming more okay with understanding that these different animals have culture, and that these are evidence of that. And so the more we can put that out and show that there's these type of things, I think is really important for the conservation of these animals.
Mm-hmm.
So
for sure.
Very, very interesting paper. So again, we'll post the notes, the link to the paper in the notes. It is open access, as Kat mentioned. It is Harassment and Killing of Porpoises, Phocenocide by Fish-Eating Southern Resident Killer Whales by Giles et al. And just thank you to all the authors for doing the study. It is so fascinating and just such a great addition to the literature. And it's a great example of everybody working together to mm-hmm. learn more about these animals so that we can help protect them. So kudos to all the authors and everybody that was out on the water looking and observing these behaviors. So with that, we will let you guys go. And next episode will be a marine mammal highlight. So keep an eye on the Instagram and Facebook stories for your chance to choose what we do next. Remember, we are getting low on our marine mammals to go over. So if you have other topics or the things you want us to discuss as we start to dwindle on the animals that we have left, please let us know either social media or by email. And then we're excited to announce that the next journal review has been picked by a audience member. So
yay!
Yeah, it was super awesome. So she reached out via social media on our Instagram account, and a new paper came out about a really cool killer whale. It's an old story and quite famous in different parts, but learning more about the genetic history of that animal and what that means with what happened to them in the past. So it's a very interesting paper that just came out. And so she wanted to have that one done. So we will be doing that one on the next journal review. So thank you very much for that suggestion. And if anybody else has suggestions like that, please let us know. Don't forget to visit our website for our merch store. Christmas is coming up. So just saying.
Get in there.
Some cool stuff. And actually there is more colors available now. I thought that the colors were available the whole time, but apparently I misplaced like having to click a button to have it be on the page. So now there are more options of colors, and we might have some more options of other things popping up there soon too. So keep an eye on that. So with that, we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Check out our website, www.pacmam.org, that's PACMAM, to learn more about us, our research, and the educational opportunities that we provide. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks!